Thanks, everybody. Welcome to session four of the Marxism 2018 conference. You are in Lessons from Struggle, the West Virginia Teachers' Strike. My name's Ben Hillier. I'll be chairing the session. I'm editor of Red Flag newspaper. Firstly, the building is open the whole weekend and will serve coffee, morning tea, lunch and dinner. There's no need to leave the campus for anything. Lunch and dinner are available from food trucks on Dodd Street, just out the front of this building. And there are eating areas on the grassy area outside the gallery down here, through the gates next to the theatre building, and also in the... this is the theatre building, and also in the foyer downstairs where there's a bar. And dinner is available immediately after this session. There is also a mammoth bookstall just down the bottom of the stairs and around to your right. There are thousands of books in there on every topic imaginable, so please check that out today and before you leave over the weekend. Our speaker for this session is Becca Bohr. Becca currently resides in Derry in Ireland. She's a member of People Before Profit and the Socialist Workers Network. Becca's also an American. And she was a shop steward with the Chicago Teachers Union and a participant in the monumental Chicago Teachers Strike in 2012. So please make her welcome for her first Marxism in Australia. And I'll hand it over.
Thank you guys so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And obviously from the number of you in this room, the struggle in West Virginia has clearly captured the hearts, the minds, the excitement of millions of people, not just in the United States, obviously, but really across the world. And I think it was unbelievably exciting to watch. So like you, I was not in West Virginia, but I was glued to my computer, watching news feed and watching videos, and to see such the defiance, the joy, the dignity that was won through this strike. It looked like such a festival on the streets of West Virginia and in the Capitol, such unity that we don't see every day. The seas of women in particular standing up and really feeling their power. I think the chants, the singing of Country Roads, the tears, the iconic image of them all on the steps of the Capitol, holding each other's hands with their fists up in the air, I think speaks to the type of unity, power that we can all hope to be part of struggles like that at some point, hopefully sooner rather than later. I think the pictures of the Capitol and the swarms of teachers and supporters and students inside really, for me, felt like I was looking back in 2011 at the protest, the uprising in Wisconsin, where Wisconsin public sector workers filled the Capitol as well. The sea of red reminded me of the CTU strike, the strike that I was part of, because we wore our red, and red has become one of the colors of the teachers' fight in the United States. The parents and the students, and seeing students organizing their own protests in West Virginia in solidarity and in support of their teachers, reminds me of looking across today the massive student protests in the United States, and the fact that West Virginia, you know, took off and had such an amazing victory, but now we're looking at Oklahoma, Arizona, Kentucky, Jersey City, etc. It was so inspiring, this idea that there can be a spark, and that spark can flame and move on. I think one of the major things that we learned is that if you fight, you have a possibility, and you can win if you fight and if you have that kind of unity. This was a battle which they won, and the war continues. So hopefully in this talk, I'm going to talk about West Virginia in particular, talk about the context in West Virginia, the context in the United States, and the attack on unions, as well as the attack particularly on public education, and then end a little bit with what happened in Chicago and the role of socialists in organizing the types of fighting unions that we want to see. So it was an unbelievable victory in West Virginia. They won a 5% raise for themselves as well as a 5% raise for all state public workers. They won a freeze on their health insurance payments that they have to pay into it, as well as a task force being set up in order to deal with how is that actually going to be resolved in the future. I'll get into that in a second. And then they also killed a whole bunch of other bills that were pretty reactionary education bills that were on the table. Bills like expanding charter schools, which are the publicly funded private schools that have been part of undercutting public education in the United States. They killed a bill on tenure, basically getting rid of tenure rights or seniority rights of teachers and making it easier to fire them. And they killed a bill that would have cut massive amount of money out of the education system and out of the public schools. And so all of those happened while they were, you know, in this struggle for their own raises and for health care. So the key things that they were fighting over were raises and health care. So in the United States, your health insurance is pegged to your employer, and the amount that people are having to pay in terms of copays and deductibles are really insane. So even though a lot of workers might be getting maybe a small wage increase, often their take-home pay is less because of the amount that people have to pay month in and month out for insurance. And pay and this is different state to state and city to city, but in West Virginia's case, and this is why they were all at the Capitol, is because the pay and the benefits is all determined by the state legislature. And so all the teachers across West Virginia, they were all standing in solidarity with each other, not just in their own counties, because it was actually the lawmakers that were going to vote on their pay and their lawmakers to determine how much they had to pay in and what the structure of their health insurance was. So the employer pays some into the health insurance, and then the employee pays in as well. And then the state has to fund that in terms of what the employer is paying in. And so West Virginia does not have the money right now in order to continue to pay into the health insurance that they've promised their workers. So this is the crisis that the teachers in West Virginia were taking aim at and organizing against. And so that was the main thing. That's why they were going to the state house. That's why it had to be the entire state of West Virginia. And then also the health plan, just so folks know, and this is one of the reasons why the pay raise for all state workers was so important, was because it wasn't just the teachers and school service personnel's health care plan. It was the state health care plan of all state workers. And so this is why that solidarity and that unity was so important to forge from the beginning. So the timeline of the strike, really quickly, just so you have a sense of sort of how quickly it escalated and how quickly they were able to really take advantage of a moment where people were ready, I think, ready to fight. And just sort of the depths of not only desperation, but also fury and anger that was evident amongst the teachers. So this infamous Facebook page, which I'm sure everyone knows all about, that was set up to that really helped unify teachers, was set up in fall 2017 by Jay O'Neill and Emily Comer. And the whole idea was to sort of bring together teachers who were in the different unions. And so West Virginia is a right to work state. Right to work is a reactionary set of anti-union laws, where collective bargaining is illegal, unions, there's no such thing as a closed shop union. So if you're working in a school, there could be two other unions in that school with you. So there isn't collective bargaining. There's no agency fees or fees that non-union members have to pay to a union if there's a collective bargaining agreement. I don't know if I'm speaking another language. I don't know if it's the same thing. Okay. You have to nod. So I'm like, okay, same language here. Happy days. So right to work. So no collective bargaining. And it's illegal to strike. Yeah, that was the other important one. So striking was illegal. And so the whole concept of this Facebook page was to sort of bring together people from other unions who weren't necessarily talking to each other about what was happening in their schools. So in November, there was a budget hearing, and in the town hall and in the state house that was sort of showing out how bleak the future looked for the funding of public education, and in particular the health insurance for these teachers. And across West Virginia, in all the different counties, there were these town hall meetings that were organized by sort of local reps about this healthcare insurance situation. And some of the changes that were coming down the road that were being announced were things like moving your health insurance to being not just based on your own income, but on your family income, therefore increasing your sort of the level of the pay that it would be based upon, meaning that you would have to pay more of a premium if you earned more money. So going from individual to family was a huge way to make working class people pay more. Additionally, there was a well-being monitor, which is basically, we had this in Chicago. This was one of the things we lost, a concession out of our strike. So basically, you had to log in and talk about like how healthy you're being. So like you would get points for like exercising or like doing mindfulness or like reading an article or like a healthy recipe, and then and you would like log it in, and you had to do like a certain number of points a week. But then they also penalized you if you had unhealthy behavior, and unhealthy behavior was like, did you smoke? Did you not exercise? You know, do you like sugar? You know, those types of things. And so, I mean, first of all, like, it was a pain in the ass. Like, it took all this time to do, but then also it's penalizing people and forcing people to pay more for their health insurance based on their health, which is, like, unbelievably disgusting and reactionary. So that was one of those things that people were just like, screw you. Like, this is an invasion of my privacy. This is unnecessary. Like, why are you making us do it? And this sort of sense of like, we have more dignity than this. And I think that's an important spark that was part of this. Additionally, the Republican legislature removed a 2% pay raise that was in an education bill the previous year. And so then on Martin Luther King Day, which is in January, there was a rally at the State House, and there was like 150 people there, not a ton of teachers there. But at the State House, they were learning more and more about what these cuts to their health care was going to actually look like. And so one of the teachers who went there actually made a video of people need to know like what's happening. So I'm going to explain it, and made this video. And that video went viral using this Facebook page across West Virginia teachers. And so more and more people actually knew what was happening. And so this Facebook page was really an organizing tool, telling people to go out and learn more and more about what was happening and to go and, you know, bother your local legislators in order to make them make some change. After that, people started doing information sessions, like really small, like in school-based, and then in their counties. And an important turning point was there was a meeting that was organized in Mingo County, which is a history of, it's where the Matewan was and the Battle of Blair Mountain. There's a long history of Union militancy there in the coal fields. And in Mingo County, there was a meeting where they were talking about, so what do we do? How do we actually escalate this? And they started talking about a blue flu or a sick out day or Fed Up Friday, so all different names different counties use for a sick in. So all the workers would be sick at the same time. At this meeting, the legislators were there, the unions were there, all three unions reps were there, teachers were there. It was a packed out meeting. And this is when they started saying, well, listen, like, we're going to have to up the ante somehow. The sick out's a great idea. We'll do that. And a woman got up and said, you know, let's be honest. We're going to need to strike. I struck in 1990, which was the last time that West Virginia went on strike. And what's really important to know is that a sick out's all well and good, but we're not going to get what we want through a sick out. And everyone was sort of like, well, okay, we're serious now. Like, we're actually talking about an illegal strike. We're actually talking about, and the whole question was, can we actually get the support? And so these types of messages were going back through the Facebook page and all of that. And so Mingo County, as well as three other counties, went out for their sick-in on the 2nd of February, and they all went to the Capitol. And they were like, we're going to go to the Capitol, and we're going to stay there. We're going to make as much noise as possible to try to get others on board. And so they went there, and they had a protest. The whole state was looking at them and saying, okay, like, if they're going out, who are the next people? So a few weeks later, 7 more counties went out, a second, again, up to the Capitol. What was important in this is this time is one of the counties that went out, which really felt like it was a turning the tide type moment, is one of the counties that went out was a county that didn't go out in 1990 in the last strike. And so I think that there was a sense after that, like, well, if they're willing to go out, and this is like, that's it, like, we have this state, so this feeling of solidarity. And so they started going back to their schools, and they started saying, right, we have to have union meetings. Union meeting is the wrong word. School-based meetings, because half, if not more, of the teachers are not unionized. So school-based meetings of all people who work in the schools to determine whether or not we're ready for a strike. And so sort of school after school, county after county sort of came back and said, we're right, we're balloting, we're ready for a strike. We're going to actually do it. And so on the 2nd and 3rd of February was the official walkout that was planned by the unions. They went on strike, and it was glorious. They had shifts going down to the Capitol, and they picketed their own areas and all of that as well. They then were offered a deal on the 27th on Tuesday night, a deal that the unions and the governor came up with for a 5% raise for the teachers, a 3% raise for the rest of state workers, and this task force that was going to look at what to do with this health insurance. And I just want to read. So they had this press conference where they announced that, and then they then the union leaders came out to address all of the teachers and the school service personnel and everyone who is out there at the Capitol. And Jay O'Neill, who's a teacher from Charleston, he explained, I'm just going to read the quote. 15 minutes after the press conference, union leaders came out and addressed the crowd. The basic problem was that they presented this deal as a victory. They told us we'd be out on strike one more day and then return to school on Thursday. We were up in arms, really frustrated. Of course, a 5% raise is great. But what we've really been fighting for in this struggle is about the health care. This has been a huge issue, causing problems for years. They've been cutting our health insurance over and over, making it really expensive to survive. So when it was announced that all we got on it was a task force, we were extremely upset. Teachers in the crowd started interrupting and yelling, "We're not going back for that." Everyone started chanting, "We are the union bosses! We are the union bosses!" And back to the table, renegotiate. Strikers had this sense of power, and we don't want to back down. We weren't satisfied, and again, this is because of health insurance. People are nervous and rightly cynical that the state government doesn't actually have any intention to fix this. And a lot of teachers are now waking up. And so that sense of, like, we're the union, we're powerful, we have this unity, we're not backing down yet, and this is our demand and you need to deal with it, I think really fired them up. So they had a cooling off period. So this deal was made, cooling off period, which is the day in which people cool off, I guess, get less angry, and then go back into work. So the cooling off day, all of the union, or all of the sort of teacher leaders went back to the staff at their school and were like, "What do you guys want to do?" And people were like, "We're not doing it. We're not doing it." And so slowly, school by school, county by county, reports came back in saying, "No, we reject this deal. We're staying out." And so at that moment, it became an even more illegal strike, a wildcat strike, because it went against sort of what the union leadership was putting out there. And so then they basically said, "We're not leaving until we actually see the legislature sign the bill that gives us those raises and all of that." And so that sort of came up for the next few days and where they won those sort of remarkable things just 2 days later. And so I think that's like so epic and exciting. It's like, that never happens, that people like reject what the union comes through and all of that. And I think that some of the stories that we heard about how that was sort of built up really speaks to why they had the confidence to reject that deal. So part of it was that there were people there who were part of the 1990 strike, and they wanted so badly to win so much more than they had won then. Another feeling of this, like, actual unity was not just these teachers, but, you know, the bus drivers and the cafeteria workers and all those other folks were on strike as well, and particularly, like, the bus drivers. There's a story where someone in a teacher was like, I don't know, like, I think people might show up for school tomorrow, like, I think we should go in, like, all this was before the strike, and the bus driver was like, dude, like, we're not driving anyone to school. It's closed. Like, don't worry. And so this idea of, like, wait, we're actually all in this in this together. And I don't know if folks have seen the panel that the ISO in the U.S. and Jacobin put on of strikers from West Virginia, but it's worth looking up and reading. And one thing I was really struck at is how similar the stories were to the types of ways that we built unity in Chicago, and the types of things that we did in order to build unity in our schools, to build solidarity with our students and parents and community members, and the way that we were able to build a fight that wasn't just about us, but it was about the class in general. And some of the things that really struck with me, so that story about the bus driver, in Chicago we did mock strike votes before we had our official strike vote to make sure that we would get enough votes to go on strike. And I remember I was standing there at the table and having this mock, and the entire cafeteria staff came to sign the strike vote. And they're not in the union. They're in a completely different union that wasn't the CTU and wasn't on strike, but they were like, we just want you to know that we'll all support you. We're so excited about this strike that we actually would like to vote for you so that you can go out on strike. And that sense of solidarity amongst different workers. Additionally, you know, the villain in this was Mitch Carmichael, who's the Republican Senate president. He was the one that a lot of the ire was aimed towards, and they had all sorts of songs like Move Mitch, Get Out the Way. Do you know that song? Get Out the Way, Mitch, Get Out the Way. T-shirts saying ditch Mitch and all that. The sort of the creativity that comes with the sense of dignity and fight back is so important. And so one of the ways that they built up the solidarity between students, parents, and workers is one thing that they did sort of early on was they had walk-ins before school. We did this in Chicago as well, where you would have basically a rally information session in the parking lot before you would go into school. So you weren't breaking any union rules, you didn't disrupt school at all, but it was to begin to raise awareness about what it was that you were actually fighting for, what were your demands, and how you saw this as a broader struggle. Additionally, wearing red, so we had for, must have been a year before the strike in Chicago, we would have Wear Red Fridays. We all would wear red. And I remember being very afraid of my school. In particular, at the time, we had there was some targeting of the previous union delegate. And so, like, we would wear, like, red shirts. But, like I'm originally from Boston, so I'm a Boston Red Sox fan. And so I would wear, like, a Boston Red Sox red shirt. Like, not a union red shirt, just to sort of feel like you had a little bit of cover, just in case someone was asking why you were wearing red. So there was sort of that, like, slowly building solidarity up until the point where every single person was wearing red, where you'd have everyone who wore red take pictures, and this was happening in West Virginia as well. And there's one story about a school in West Virginia where everyone was wearing red, but they were wearing United Mine Worker Union T-shirts. So they were linking very explicitly to the other struggles that had come before in West Virginia. Additionally, in terms of building solidarity, one of the big things is that school provides free lunches for students. And so one of the thing that teachers in West Virginia did is they said, right, if we're going to close school, our students still need to get fed. So how are we? I mean, such an indictment of U.S. society that this is how people get their food. But it also shows how much, you know, obviously the teachers cared about the welfare of the families and the students that they touched. And so in different counties, they did different things. In some counties, they packed school like backpacks of food and sent them home with the kids. Other counties, actually, when they were out on strike, they made lunches there, and kids came and got fed and sort of livened it all up. In other counties, they worked with churches and other like volunteer organizations to make sure that people got fed. And I think that when this was such an explicit plan of saying, this, like, we're all in this together and we care so much about people getting fed, people in West Virginia started saying, wait, these teachers are really fighting for us. And I think that was something in Chicago that was really important, because one of the slogans that we would say is that our working conditions are your learning conditions, and so we're actually fighting for the same thing. And the other thing is, we talked about the schools Chicago students deserve, the society Chicago deserves, and within it we had, it was like a little pamphlet of all of the very localized problems and things that were happening in the schools, the things we wanted to see change, and then importantly, the revenue, the ways, the very, very concrete ways in Chicago that we could raise that revenue in order to pay for it. And so once the actual line that people were hearing, the reason for the strike, was so much broader than just that one group of workers and just their one wage packet, although that is important, it began to see that this is a class struggle that goes across the working class, and that we're really all in this together. And so it was, you know, obviously incredible, but I think what's also incredible is trying to understand what is the actual context of the United States right now. So in West Virginia is known for being coal country. 10 years ago, and only 10 years ago, coal was booming in West Virginia, and now it's pretty much completely gone. Walmart's the number one employer in the state, which is a low-wage economy, obviously, very low protection. Mingo County, one of the teachers there, Katie Endicott, she was talking about how families were making over $100,000 10 years ago working in coal, and now they're going to bread lines, they're going to soup kitchens, they literally can't feed their families. There's no work in the county, and so you see a lot of people leaving. There's no plan after that decimation. Poverty rates are insane. 50% of children are in poverty in West Virginia. It's the second poorest state in the United States, and teachers make 47th out of 50 on the list of low wages, so 47th out of all the teachers. Teachers literally couldn't afford the health care rates that they were having to pay in. It wasn't just a case of, oh, I don't want to have to pay this much out of my wage, but the people literally couldn't afford it, and so people were having to leave. Folks might know about the opioid epidemic in the United States. West Virginia has the highest drug overdose death rate in the nation. More than 880 people died of an overdose in 2006 just in West Virginia. The opioid epidemic's for another talk, another day, but it's worth saying that a lot of the drugs that the prescription drugs that sort of led into the or sort of gatewayed into the opioid addiction were very much because of for-profit pharmaceuticals. Areas were flooded with prescription drugs, and so over the past decade, out-of-state drug companies shipped 20.8 million prescription painkillers into two pharmacies in one town of 3,000 people in Mingo County. And so it gives you a sense of just how much, you know, the profit system is not working for working class people. Additionally, in West Virginia, there are massive tax cuts to corporations. In 2006, the Democratic governor slashed corporation taxes from 9 to 6.5%. which amounts to a loss of revenue of about $425 million. Obviously, I just went over that West Virginia is a right-to-work state, and so all of the difficulties in terms of union organizing, with not only coal leaving more precarious work coming in, that there is the just union density has, you know, gone through the floor in terms of that. Additionally, interestingly, in West Virginia, Trump won sort of flying colors, but so did in the Democratic primary, Sanders won. So they went from voting, majority for Sanders to then Trump sweeping. And so I think that one of the things that it shows is that people are desperate for something different, and they don't. The politics on offer are not good enough. In the United States in general right now, I think there's three things to sort of, or four things to think about. One is Trump. Two, the 40-year attack on unions. Three, particularly the 25-year attack, particularly on the privatizing of public education, the attack on education. And then four, the volatility that has clearly happened because of all of this. And so Trump, obviously, he's for, cutting corporation tax. I'm going to sort of go a little bit faster. Cutting corporation tax, tack on, science and the environment and, rational thinking, and obviously the racism, the misogyny, and all of that. And I think Trump as a president really is the embodiment of the combination of corporate and political greed and rot that goes, to the top of U.S. society. The governor in West Virginia was a Democrat and then switched to be a Republican in order to campaign for Trump. And he is a coal and agribusiness tycoon, a tax dodger who's having some issues with the law in terms of paying taxes for companies he was in charge of. But one of the reasons why he's such a fan of Trump is because he's all about cutting corporation tax. He's about getting rid of environmental regulation and all of that as well. Unions have been really attacked in the past 40 years, similarly to here, really low union density. And where unions do exist, they're quite bureaucratic, top-heavy, basically in a partnership with not making much progressive change for folks whatsoever. And right now, I think one of the terrifying things we're seeing is that union strongholds of the United States, areas that used to be where car manufacturing was, the middle of America, Michigan and Ohio and Illinois and all those states are now look like they're going to all be right to work states within the next few years. Some of them already have, such as more and more anti-union laws and policies going through. Right now, there's a Supreme Court case, Janus versus AFSCME, which is a court case that's going to cut agency fees, cut the way that unions collect money from people who have not joined the union. Ironically, the labor argument, so the actual union members who are arguing against this, are saying that we have to keep agency fees because without agency fees, the rank and file will be too uppity and they'll start to actually organize, and you don't want that. So in order to have the social peace that we have right now, we need to make sure that we keep these agency fees so we can have the bureaucracy of the union, et cetera. But I think one of the things we're seeing, obviously, in West Virginia, what we saw in Chicago, in other places, is there is... and we're seeing in Arizona and Oklahoma, et cetera, is there is definitely an attempt to fight back. There's been a 20-year attack on public education. It started really around sort of privatization of public education. It's a huge industry, and so the privatization was around charter schools at the beginning, and I remember it was only 15 years ago, really, that charter schools were seen as, the next best thing. We're going to reform education. It's going to be amazing. And people really did think that. And it's only been in the past 10 years or so that narrative has really begun to shift. The devaluation of teachers, both in terms of pay, but also in terms of this idea of anyone can teach. You're smart. You're bright. You have a little bit of grit. You can teach. We'll put you in the poorest schools in the country, and you'll do a great job. And so there's been a lot of programs like Teach for America and other programs that are in different school districts that are really all about, coming to teach for one or two years and then go on to your real jobs, like becoming a lawyer or like working in the financial district or whatever. And so all of that has devalued teaching, devalued the curriculum, and also been really, really a force of instability within schools. There's been massive school closings. This goes with undercutting of public education and underfunding it, which then leads to overcrowding, obviously. There's been a serious testing regime, which dumbs down the curriculum, and it widens the gap between the type of education that is taught in sort of middle class. I mean, elite education is always going to be elite education, but this widened the gap between the type of schooling that was in sort of middle class, like suburbs or middle class schools, and your poor schools. And then obviously the union busting that has gone along with it. The current, what is it called? It's not a minister in the U.S. I'm like forgetting. Secretary, thank you. Secretary of Education in the U.S. is Betsy DeVos. She's a billionaire, homophobe. Oh, you all know all about how horrible she is. A complete religious nut. She has no connection to public school whatsoever. She's never been to one. She's never sent a kid to one. She's never taught in one. She's probably never seen one. She is horrendous. She actually doesn't even believe in public education. And when she was in Michigan, she voted against public education to continue and really or lobbied against it. And she is pro-charter and actually pro-voucher, which is paying families to then take that money and then be able to go to private school. And so this whole idea of like school choice, people should be able to go to whatever school. Students should be able to go to whatever school they want is a way to undercut public education and to put public money into private schools. And the voucher program in particular allows to go around the loophole of a separation of church and state in the United States, because you can send a voucher to a religious school rather than just charter schools, which are still technically supposed to be have a separation between church and state, generally speaking, although not always. And then, so this attack on public education has meant that we have seen some fightbacks in terms of teachers. And the volatility we've seen in the past year of Trump, I think, should be very exciting for us in terms of beginning to see some actual fightback. There's been basically nonstop protests every day, but there has been a serious amount of protest, and I think is really exciting. And I think that when we look at from West Virginia to Oklahoma, Oklahoma just, was it 2 days ago, I think, rejected a deal of $6,000 wage increase. Their demand is $10,000, and they said, we're still going on strike until we get what we want. They are the last in the country for pay, and they make sort of on average something like $35,000, so a 10% raise is a serious increase in their wage. Arizona has had a sick-in just this past week, March 21st, and they have a red for ed movement. In Kentucky, they've begun their sick-ins, and sort of we'll see what's going to happen. Kentucky has 120 counties, so it's bigger than West Virginia, and so trying to organize that. And it's really, really exciting because they're all linking up with each other and standing in solidarity. So just, I'm gone over, so I'm just going to say a few things about the CTU fight, because I think it's really important because it is the reference point for teachers' struggles in the United States and the fight for public education. The reason why we were able to go on strike is because we had a reform caucus leading the union core, the Caucus of Rank and File Educators. And the Caucus of Rank and File Educators core was started up a decade before the strike with the intention of being able to reawaken a rank-and-file activity within the union and actually fight for the type of public education that we need to fight for. It was started by a handful, and by a handful, I mean literally a handful, less than 10, self-identified socialists within the Chicago Teachers Union and a few different socialist groups that started by talking about the ways in which privatization was destroying public education. They started with a discussion group around Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, and they talked about how does this apply to public education and how do we understand what's happening in Chicago and across this country when it comes to the gutting out of public education and what's our role as teachers to begin to fight against it. Then the school closures started happening in Chicago and the union wasn't fighting for them. So this group of teachers, they weren't even core yet, sort of really got together and said, right, we're going to go to all these school hearings and say, don't close our schools, and we're going to start a movement of that. And so more and more became self-identified as, this is the caucus that fights, that's against the what both Democrats and Republicans are doing to the education system, who are for public education, who are for a fighting union, who are for more democracy. And so that began to build, and when they contested for union leadership, people knew that if you voted for CORE, you were voting for a union that was probably going to build up towards striking at some point when the contract was up. So people knew exactly the type of militancy that they were voting for and that they were talking about. And I think that that's important, because if you're in a situation where you're like, my union's terrible, people don't really know what's going on in terms of all the different cuts to education. It sort of feels like we're up against a whirlwind of reaction. Starting small and where you are makes a big difference, as long as you have a plan about this is where we're trying to go within the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, etc. And the strike. And so once CORE got leadership, and I'll sort of wrap up on this. Like, our strike was incredible because of the way in which it activated every single union member. So they wanted to, the government wanted to stop the strike. And so what they did is they passed an anti-union law that said that in order for us to vote for a strike, 75% of all union members have to vote in favor of the strike. So not just all of those, it has to be a majority, but it has to be 75%. And not just of people who vote, but of union members. And so we knew that we had to have an absolute solid operation in every school. So we started basically, we didn't call them strike committees at the beginning. We called them contract committees. So people who were going to just talk about the contract, talk about the types of things we wanted in every single school. It gave us a sense of, right, where are our schools that we have one? Where are our schools we don't have one? What's the percentage of... So we had sort of a phone tree, so to speak, in every section of the city to have a sense of where are our strong schools, where are not our strong schools. And we started sending people school to school to have different discussions about what was in the contract, what the types of things you want to fight for, etc. And it really did start locally. It started small in order to build up from that. And I think that the reason why we won that battle in terms of the CTU strike is because every single person in Chicago knew that we were fighting for them. I said that earlier, but like, you literally, if you wore your CTU shirt, you could not like buy anything for yourself. I mean, I'm sort of overstating that, but like, high fives on the street, you know, people just loved you. You got rounds of applause with random people, smiles, like thumbs up. And I was really worried at the beginning, and that's why we had the mock vote. I mean, that's why we had like the walk-ins and all sorts of different things to really build up the support within all the different schools. But I remember we had a rally in the spring before the strike, and everyone, like, it was right in downtown Chicago. It was a big rally, tons and tons of people. There's great pictures of it. But everyone we passed, so people who were baristas in coffee shops and clerks and people who worked in offices, every single person, thumbs up, signs, like people who worked in offices, like, had signs that said, like, yes, go CTU, like, against the windows, holding them up, showing their solidarity. And so we knew that we were actually not only striking for the working class of Chicago, but supported by the working class of Chicago. But we won that battle, but we did not win the war. And I think that's really important to see the way in which these are battles, but they're battles that we have to be able to, you know, sometimes we win, but we have to weather the storm when we lose. The next year in retribution, the city of Chicago closed 50 schools, which are a huge number of people being laid off, huge disruption to schools, and that was literally because we struck. It was retribution for what we did. And the union right now, people are tired and all of that, but there's a vision of what public education could be. And so the thing that I'm so excited about is a new, excited, very fiery, filled with joy and dignity movement that is spreading right now from state to state, but that will hopefully give energy and enthusiasm to many of the other teachers' unions who have been fighting, and the members, the rank and file, who've been fighting tooth and nail for a different type of society, a different type of public education, one that is actually available and free with teachers who are respected, paid well, and have dignity. Thank you.